Hi, I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is the Marketplace Weekend Podcast for the weekend of September 26, 2014. When I was 7, I learned to walk to school by myself. It was only a few blocks, but I was incredibly proud. One right turn, one left, two blocks past the lilac trees, across the big intersection, and over the hill. 30 years later, I remember it so precisely because it was a distinct lesson in looking out for myself. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy collides with real life. Our show this week is all about looking out for yourself when you finally get that big break, or as an investor, maybe if you're a woman in the tech world, or even in a story about pants. You'll see what I mean. As always, look out for your own opinions. Tell us about them on MarketplaceWeekend.org or on Twitter. We're at Marketplace, WKND. Now let's start the show and round up your economic week in 20 seconds.
Security experts are racing to fend off potential attacks from a new cyber threat called shell shock.
Top executives at GM and its former financing arm, Ally Financial, enjoyed big paydays even while their companies struggled to repay the government for a massive bailout.
U.S. lawmakers moving to make it harder for U.S.-based companies to relocate overseas to cut their tax bills.
Let's talk about some of the other stories in the news. Plus, it's the weekend, so let's have brunch. We are out having brunch on 2nd Avenue in New York at the Pullman Kitchen, and I've got Joe Weisenthal from Business Insider, Shannon Bond from the Financial Times. Welcome to you both. Cheers.
Thank
Cheers,
you.
Cheers, guys.
Nice to have you. I want to start with, let's say, one of the most watched programs on television. In fact, if we're going to look at it from last fall, 34 of the 35 most watched TV shows, you know what I'm talking about.
The National Football League.
The National Football League. Incredibly popular on television. Massive business. How much money are we talking about?
We're talking about somewhere around $10 billion, which they're projecting could go up to $25 billion in the next few years. That's a lot of money.
It's a ridiculous amount of money. And I think the somewhere and the projection is really important. Can you explain to me why this is a guess?
Well, they are kind of a black box. First of all, they're a tax-exempt organization, and so there's not a whole lot of accountability. They don't have, other than the Green Bay Packers, they don't have shareholders. They're owned by individual owners, the teams. And, you know, the league itself, there's very, very little information out there about any of their finances. And so a lot of it's projection.
I mean, this is one of the most interesting stories to me right now. It's a business story. It's a cultural story. It's a story about kids and women and sports and all of these things together. And we're all the consumers. I am fascinated. I don't think there is anything that is more of a reflection of American society right now and how this comes into our living rooms. And yet, I'm not sure what's going to happen.
Yeah, even before the Ray Rice stuff and everything, I've thought about this. Like, how can the NFL get more popular than it is? Because it is amazing the extent to which the NFL has subsumed the culture. Not just sports. I mean, obviously it's bigger and destroying all other sports.
No, but entertainment
but
as
the
a
extent
whole.
To which entertainment as a whole conversation, I think it's one of these things where, you know, you have this incredible boom. Everyone just thinks this is only going to go up. And then suddenly you see that there are, like, these deep problems that run to the core leadership problems. It's kind of like it's how bubbles burst.
But who bursts the bubble? I mean, we are all the consumers, or are the consumers the Marriotts and Doritos and, you know, great big sponsors of the league? Shannon,
you cover
these, you know, the media side of this.
Absolutely. I mean, it's the kind of thing, it's sort of like when you're talking about, you know, any service that you're getting for free, you're probably not actually the customer, you're not the client. So, yes, in many ways, their clients are Pepsi and Anheuser-Busch. They're big sponsors who pay, you know, $1 billion a year to sponsor a team, who are paying $500,000 for a 30-second spot. Watch.
And I also think that something to think about whenever you have, like, something that's only gone in one direction, just boom, growth, that marginal changes can begin to make a big difference. And so if you're like a $10 billion now and everyone thinks it's going to be a $25 billion in just a few years, then a slight change in attitude among advertisers, a slight nervousness about being associated with the NFL brand could totally change that projection. Yeah.
Neither of you have children.
Correct.
If you had children, would you let your kids play football?
No.
You've got a double Texas thing, man. I mean, this Texas is football state. I mean,
no, I don't think so.
You wouldn't?
It seems pretty dangerous.
I want to shift to a big picture topic that affects the global economy. We've had the United Nations General Assembly this week. One of the topics that has been discussed has been climate change. We had this big climate change march. But there's an interesting thing here, which is a lot of businesses are way out in front of governments in terms of what they are doing. A lot of big companies like Kellogg's, Coke. Does any of that trickle down to consumers' daily lives?
I think it can from a reputational point of view, certainly. I mean, it is something people are more aware of. And, you know, if a company can run an ad campaign that's showing off their green credentials, I mean, that there is an increasingly large group of consumers who are going to react to that and going to think favorably. And
I guess Priuses sold out pretty fast.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I mean, it appears to be a growing trend that consumers think about where the products they come from buy. Food is the obvious example with all the people interested in how food is grown, organic foods,
GMOs,
stuff like that. GMOs, the whole farm-to-table thing. Mm-hmm. So I think that is, you know, companies are probably going to continue to be more and more mindful about their reputation when it comes to the environment. You know, I think there are other ways that companies' green initiatives matter. You know, one of the big ones is with energy companies or utilities offering the opportunity to buy green energy. That's an example of self-interest that, you know, there's a product that they could sell. Although the interesting thing is some people point out that a lot of Wall Street firms are like, they're really excited about the prospect of, say, a carbon trading and like that.
Because how much money can they make
They would love that. Yeah. So, you know, you don't have to convince them that limits on carbon would be great because they'd be thrilled about
it. Yeah, is there some irony here that, you know, the financial sector is vastly more innovative when you're talking about energy trading and green energy than a lot of governments are?
So I think, yes, but also it's still all of this comes back to the idea that these bets on energy trading or whatever come down to the hope that the government will impose regulations that necessitate these things.
And that they're operating in different, you know, different countries that already have stricter laws or that, you know, things might be changing. They have to kind of be at the cutting edge anyway. But then, I mean, it's not to say the government doesn't play a role, because none of that can exist without the energy research that, frankly, companies are not underwriting. And so there is still that government role there.
How does that affect you if you're a customer? Are you paying more upfront, maybe, for, you know, green energy credits? I don't know.
You know, I think that, like, going to, like, the Tim Cook example, so he said this past week that the new Apple headquarters would be the greenest building in the world. You know, I don't think that's going to cost the average customer that much more when they buy an iPhone. It'd probably be...
It's going to make them feel good.
Negligible. But there's nothing more important to Apple than that brand Apple. So any investment they can do to keep that brand pristine is probably a good investment.
All right, let's move into weird. What is your weird for the week?
My favorite story right now, it's been going on for the last few weeks, is this hedge fund that's trying to replace the board of Darden Restaurants, which is the parent company of Olive Garden. And the hedge fund released this huge 294-page PowerPoint deck where they detailed in incredible detail every flaw of the way Olive Garden is run.
Not salting the pasta
water.
They
didn't salt. They like had a whole slide really about the pasta water. Yeah. They had a slide about how they didn't like the manner in which they gave out unlimited breadsticks. Just an amazing, I've never seen a company's business model so thoroughly picked apart.
Whatever young associate sunk their teeth into
that. It was gripping reading. I just could not, 294 straight pages, click through every
slide. Maybe he was a wannabe restaurant reviewer. Maybe he was applying for a job.
I would like it, you know, if a company I worked for just hired someone to come in and do that and looked at, you know, examined you for like weeks and then just point out every terrible thing
you're
doing wrong.
I'm going to come in and examine your
company. I think that'd be fun. Yeah, come in. That'd be fun.
You got it. Deal. We're done. Okay. Joe Wiesenthal from Business Insider, Shannon Bond from the Financial Times. Thank you very much to you both.
Thank you.
Thanks.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend from APM. This week, we learned that defaults on federal student loans declined in 2013 for the first time in years.
13.7% of student borrowers defaulted on payments after they started coming due. That's about a point lower than last year. But defaults are still far above what they were before the recession. Student loans can be so scary, so emotional, but so key to getting an education. We asked people, how would you redesign student financial aid? We sent Marketplace Weekend producer Jenny Ament out to the University of Southern California to talk to some students. Here's what they had to say.
Cam Plunkett. I have a lot of academic scholarships, and then for financial aid, I just got a government loan so I could pay it back quickly after graduating and establish good credit.
Emily Drone. I did not get enough originally, and I had to appeal it multiple times before I got an amount that was what I thought was okay.
Madison Clift. I do have financial aid. It doesn't cover all of school, but it certainly has helped.
Marquisa Ocampo.
I'm working at Domino's. Just so you could help me pay my books. Well, it's just tiring because according to them, I get paid well, so I don't qualify.
My name is Josue Cofresi. When I started the grad school application process, I didn't have any mentors or anything explaining that I should be applying to competitive schools because, you know, schools with high endowments because they have grants, right, more money.
Brenda Saldana. I get okay in financial aid. I mean, I still have to take out loans, and I still have to pay a lot of my own money, which kind of sucked because I don't really have much money, so yeah.
I'm Will Thornberry. I definitely changed the amount of money that's given towards middle-income families. I know, especially with rising tuition, it's the people in the middle that are getting squeezed the hardest.
Lauren Beveridge. No, I don't. Because my parents made more money than the cutoff. Yeah, it's definitely a big problem.
I'm Christopher Wayne Thompson. I had financial aid. Here's a signature, there's a signature, okay. I can go to college. Well, the idea is I go to college, then once you go to college, you get a job. And it's not that easy. That's not really how it works, you know? And they call it financial aid, but it's not really, I mean, it aids you at first, but it's more like immediately it's financial debt.
Coming up, we'll hear from a financial aid advisor who gives us tips on how to get the most out of student aid and then how to get out of that debt. You just heard a bunch of different people tell their stories about student aid and student debt. From filling out those first forms to feeling like their student debt simply never leaves them. We took your questions and frustrations to a real-life financial aid worker. Her name is Catherine Morgan, and she's made a career out of financial aid. She currently works for Florida State University. Catherine Morgan, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
How long have you been working in financial aid?
For a total of about 25 years now.
I think a lot of students, when they are getting ready to apply to schools or they're getting ready to apply for financial aid, this might be the first time they've ever been faced with big financial decisions or trying to understand this stuff, and it's really scary. Do you have words of advice for them?
Start your junior year of high school. Don't wait until you decide you're going to go to college. Going to school, it is expensive, but there's actually ways to try to minimize that and try to stay away from student loans as much as possible and use it just as a last resort.
What did you do? I'm curious.
When I started at 19, I went to the financial aid office and I said, my mother's single and she's raising two children. Is there any help? And they said, first words, does your mother own her own home? And the answer was yes. And they said, okay, you don't qualify. Well, being 19 and not knowing, you just say, okay, you know, they have my best interest. Well, actually, they don't. You're just one less person they have to do the paperwork on. So I always encourage students that I want to educate you so that you can make an educated decision on how to financially get your education because it's very important. And so always do the FAFSA. Don't let anybody tell you that you make too much money or that you own your own home and that's going to disqualify you. You'll never know what's going to disqualify you from the federal Pell Grant, and it's the only thing you really get disqualified for. Sometimes scholarships, that's what they are, like a patchwork quilt. You've got maybe $500 here and $300 there, and it all adds up together so that you don't have to take the student loans, and I was actually lucky that I didn't have to.
We asked
a lot of people in our community online and, you know, our listeners, what they would do if they could design their own student loan program. And we heard from a lot of people who said, I'm in this weird position because my parents make too much money for me to qualify for aid, but not enough to pay outright. What do you say to people who are in that position?
Students don't have a credit check for those student loans. They don't need a co-signer. They just need to fill out the FAFSA and be enrolled in at least 6 hours. But what happens is a lot of the schools is they'll say, well, get your parents to do a PLUS loan. Well, then that parent has that loan debt also, and that's where there's so much money being borrowed.
You work for a university. Do you think universities have the students' best interest at heart? I remember going to the financial aid office and feeling like maybe the financial aid office and the lenders were in this together and not knowing who I could trust.
I could see where you would get that impression. I mean, it was the first impression I got, that they didn't really care about me. They just cared about where's the money, you know, that you're going to pay for your classes, and I don't care how you get it. Not all schools are like that, or not all financial aid people are like that. And that's why I take a lot of pride in educating students on this is how it works. Let's be a team. I can't do it all for you, but I can help you. And I would hope that other financial aid people feel that same way. But sometimes it's the sheer volume of students approaching them with financial aid issues versus how many people you have available to actually process that information.
Are there a couple quick things that students should keep in the back of their minds so that they can be their own best advocate?
Don't just stick with your program of study. Also, like, do you like writing poetry? There's scholarships out there for poetry. Do you have a dog? There's scholarships out there for dog lovers. There's all kinds of things out there. It's just like a treasure hunt. It's so amazing. But the students have to be motivated to want to do that instead of coming in and saying, well, here, you're in financial aid. You find me the money. No, we need to work together. I'll help you find the money, but you still have to do the application.
What about after graduation? I've heard from students who feel like the loan bills are animated demons following them around.
Well, you get a 6-month grace period from your last date of attendance. So let's say you get your bachelor's, you take the summer off, you come and get your master's. But let's say after the 6 months, you can't find a job. So what do? You can actually contact your servicer, tell them what's going on, communicate with them. There's a lot of programs out there if you go to the FAFSA website that tell you what to do, you know, how you can get assistance so that maybe you don't have to pay right now.
Catherine Morgan, thank you so much for talking with us.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Next week, we want to talk about escape plans. The average U.S. household credit card debt stands at $15,607. What amazing things have you done or are you planning to do to get out of debt? Any debt. Come commiserate, gloat, or just share your story on MarketplaceWeekend.org or tweet us. We're at Marketplace, WKND. Every week on the show, we bring you one story where money or the pursuit of it changes somebody's life. This week, a story about how to look out for yourself when you go from sleeping in a park to sailing on a yacht with celebrities.
Hi, I am Jerry Stahl. I'm a writer. My latest books are Happy Mutant Baby Pills, and the new one coming out next year is Weird Shit Happens When You Don't Die Young, My Life as an OG Dad. OG as an old guy who can't tell from my voice. I was kind of the junkie Horatio Alger. Before my first book, Permanent Midnight, I was squatting in the basement of a crack house off of Hollywood Boulevard with no plumbing to speak of. Power was sketchy in the building. To get to my room, I had to walk down a long, completely dark hall. Dark as in no light whatsoever. Nothing but the skittering of carefree little rat feet. Not to get sentimental. This, by the way, was after I'd gotten clean, at the ripe age of 38. The first money was for the book itself, which was insane money for me. And I couldn't even get a lawyer to help with the contract because the lawyer I had, I'd borrowed so much money off of. He just didn't believe me. So as publishers and studios do, they give you the just most heinous, insulting contract as the first offer. But I, of course, just took it because I didn't have a lawyer and I'm a moron. When Ben Stiller bought the rights to the movie, that was, of course, an even bigger deal than selling the book. The book was a nice chunk of money, a huge chunk of money for a guy who had like 13 cents in a, you know, in the sock drawer that I didn't even have. But I was still working my way up to socks. But the great thing about you option the movie, and then there's the promise that on the first day of principal photography, you'll get that giant six-figure check, which was just unthinkable to me at that time. But it actually happened. But, of course, long before that happened, the money for the movie went away, and it looked like for a while it might not even happen. But Stiller asked me to write a movie with him. I went from semi-homeless to flying to St. Bart on a private jet, me and my one pair of clunky steel-toed boots and shiny pants, shiny from not being washed, not because they were shark skin, and a gaggle of stylish millionaires. We got invited to a party on Russell Simmons' yacht. Mr. Simmons looked me up and down. My sidewalk flattened at the heel, junky boots, those shiny pants, the t-shirt I fished from a dumper with Valdez Plumbing and Septic. Needless to say, I spent the whole time on the yacht wishing I was back in MacArthur Park with the junkies and crackheads. My people. It was the kind of transition that can give you the bends, financial as well as every other way. It's not the big money that matters. In my experience, it's going from zero to 100 or zero to 10 that really makes a difference. And two things happen, I think, when you don't have money and suddenly you have a bundle thrown at you, which is, one, you get incredibly grateful. Two, you're just gripped by terror because you're so used to having nothing that as soon as you have something, you're convinced it's going to go away. So for a while, I was scared to spend any money at all. And then I went the other way and just spent it all as fast as I could because I was much more comfortable being broke. I don't know if you ever figure out that balance, but eventually you just die. It works itself out. Call me a cockeyed optimist.
Author Jerry Stahl. His latest novel is Happy Mutant Baby Pills. You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. Here's a story for investors who want to look out for themselves. We want to demystify something that's happening in the economy right now. Since September of 2011, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has gained almost 7,000 points. And that's made for a lot of investors like this guy.
Hi, I'm Colin. I work. I'm a consultant working here in LA for the next couple months. I have an account with Wealthfront. They're like a robo advisor. In my personal investment account, I've definitely made a lot of money there. So I've got high hopes for the future.
And as stock prices have risen, so too have the number of corporate buybacks. That's when a company buys back its own stock from shareholders.
And usually you do this for a variety of reasons.
That's Sharon O'Halloran. She's a professor who studies political economics at Columbia University. And with corporate buybacks happening at such a high rate, the highest, in fact, since right before the start of the financial crisis, we wanted to put those buybacks in context. So we visited O'Halloran at her office. She said one reason for companies to buy back shares is to shore up the value of the stock. Basically, if there are fewer shares out there, each one becomes more valuable.
A second reason why a company would buy back their own shares, and this is usually for smaller firms, is if there's been dilution of their shares, that there's a large supply of shares on the market. And that usually happens if a company has been issuing bonuses through giving their own employees their own stock. And then a third reason, and this is a more cynical reason, is it's a way to increase the earnings per share. That is, by reducing the supply of stock on the market, you obviously make the earnings per share higher.
When you look at the numbers, there's some research out that says in the last 2 years,
big companies have purchased about $950 billion of their own stock. That's researched by S&P Capital IQ. What's going on? Why this big frenzy now?
So what we've seen is that a lot of acquisitions and mergers taking place. So if you wanted to be acquired, you many ways you want to make sure that you're in a good, strong position in your books and your earnings ratios. And so that's one reason you might see it. Another reason, if you're acquiring a firm, you might want to have a high price so that you can buy off the company at a lower ratio. So those are some of the things that we've seen. And in particular, the Germans and other European countries have actually taken a very aggressive stance in the United States and have been some of the largest purchasers of companies.
If you're a big company with a lot of cash, if you're Google, if you're Apple, it doesn't seem like it matters that much because you can do basically whatever you want with your cash, right?
Right. So lots of times Google and Apple have not been giving out dividends previously in the past. They now have started. So they would purchase the shares back as a way to increase the value of shareholders.
So if you own that stock, you're psyched.
If you own that stock, you're happy. So those are the ways in which a company might trade off their investments for their shareholders when they have large amounts of cash.
There's an argument that some people make, and that was made in the Harvard Business Review, that some share buybacks exacerbate inequality, that this just leads to pumping up the wealth of stockholders at the expense of, say, research and development, of long-term investment, and basically makes the rich richer. What do you make of that?
Well, it is true that the top 20% of the income bracket, and really most of the capital stocks and so forth, are held at the very high income levels or net worth levels. So that is true. And the extent to which these buybacks raise the value of the stock, the net worth of those individuals clearly go up. So in that sense, it will be exacerbating income inequality. In addition, if a company is not hiring new people, then in fact there'll be less jobs, less job competition, less wage pressure, and consequently, yes, the difference between the net worth of the high end and the net worth of someone who doesn't own a stock or doesn't have a job will clearly be exacerbated. And in many ways, you see also that executives are paid in stock.
Yeah, I want to ask you a separate question about executives. There's a key part of this that can sometimes get overlooked, which is executive compensation and how price-to-earnings ratios and buybacks can figure into how the bosses get paid. Can you explain that to me?
Well, say the boss makes $1 million in straight-up salary, and if, in fact, they meet certain targets, such as revenues or net income or what have you, they will get a bonus based on that type of performance. If one of the indicators that they look at is the earnings to price of a share, then in fact they will be enabling themselves to meet that target, either artificially or not through their own activities. Okay. And in addition, if they get that money through shares, then in fact they're just making themselves wealthier.
So it's kind of boosting their own income times two.
You would say they may have a conflict of interest in looking at some of these imperatives of whether they are in fact going to do a stock buyback or not. Yes.
Should we be skeptical of that?
You might. However, if in fact the management are only looking at the short-term price fluctuations of the stock, the long-term profitability of the business will be going down. And so if I was a board of directors, I would not be giving only 1 year, but I would look out 3 to 5 years on how I would put in pay and compensation. And you have seen that take place, especially in the financial sector, where there are many government controls and regulations around compensation. And then there's been a lot of debate about how the top executives should be compensated because of risk and issues along those lines.
Sharon O'Halloran, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
And that brings us to the weekend number. 740. That's how many companies have authorized corporate stock buybacks this year. That's according to the Wall Street Journal. Meanwhile, companies have purchased about $338 billion of their own stock. That's according to the research firm Barini Associates. That, too, is the most since the financial crisis. How useless women's pockets are?
I borrowed my wife's pants because they're like those super stretchy pants. But I realized when I was driving that all my stuff would always fall out of the pockets. And it never hit me until right now that they're just smaller pockets.
Coming up, why our pockets are so small, a history. Coming up on Marketplace Weekend from APM. It's no secret that the tech industry struggles to hire women. We asked one female CEO, Catherine Minshew of The Muse, to share her experience in the industry. She developed a company through an incubator program for startups called Y Combinator. Still, her first company wasn't exactly a success.
Hi, I'm Catherine Minshew, the founder and CEO of TheMuse.com, which is an online career development platform targeting millennials. The idea for the company really came out of my own personal job search. Like many people, I wasn't always sure what it was that I wanted to do professionally. I then went to McKinsey & Company and spent a couple years management consulting and took a complete kind of 180 and moved to Kigali, Rwanda in East Africa and worked on vaccine introduction for 6 months with the Clinton Health Access Initiative. And I came back to the U.S. in September of 2010 and started my first company, which was called PYP, and it didn't end up working out. It was actually a complete failure. I lost all my money in it, which was very sad at the time, and still now. And when you go through something like that, it also makes you pretty tough. It makes you a little less flappable in a way. We went through Y Combinator for The Muse. Like many places in tech, there were not a huge number of female founders and an even smaller number of female CEOs. First of all, I think the technology industry is such a phenomenal place to be right now overall. I think there's so much happening and so much disruption that it's a really exciting industry to be a part of. That said, like many industries, there are definitely still challenges. The New York Times wrote a piece on unconscious and systematic bias. And I think a lot of people today aren't necessarily intending to be biased against one group or another. Yet research consistently shows that when you provide, scientists with a lab application from an identical graduate student, but change the name from John to Jennifer, they rate her 20% less competent and offer her $6,000 less salary. When, women musicians play behind a screen, they're rated equally to men. But when the gender of the performer, be it a violinist or a woodwind player, is known, people generally think the women sound less good. I'll say I've been lucky to meet an incredible number of people and have incredible supporters in both male and female. But I do also think that I have to often work, particularly in the early days of my business, particularly hard to be taken seriously as a founder. One of the stories I think is so interesting is one of my co-founders is a back-end Python engineer, and her name is Melissa. And when I tell people this, sometimes people say, "Oh, that's so great. How good is she?" And I think that's so funny because I have never once in, you know, all of my years heard someone ask, how good is he? Unless it was a job interview or really performance question. And it's fascinating because Melissa was a, you know, summa cum laude physics major from Harvard. So actually she's very, very good. But the default was always that people just assumed she must be learning or trying or versus an extremely, extremely competent individual in her own right. When I started kind of jokingly teasing people like, wow, would you ask that if, you know, his name was Mark? People got really embarrassed because they realized it was really unintentional. I think we all sometimes catch ourselves making these snap judgments about someone. And I do think sometimes, especially if you don't know much else about someone, gender leads you to make different assumptions than you might if it was a man in question. For me, creating more visible role models of smart, successful women in technology is actually very important because it shows people that they too can follow that path. There's a great phrase which says, you can't be what you can't see. I also think it's really good business sense right now to focus on, in general, opportunities that are underserved. You know, the world has a lot of, you know, of apps that will deliver you something that you really want in 5 minutes or less. And that's not that that's a bad thing. But to me, when I look at some of the problems being tackled by entrepreneurs from less traditional backgrounds, they're really interesting and they have not seen the same innovation. And so when you look at some of the startups right now targeting parents, for example, you know, there's a lot of money to be made in taking different people's experiences seriously, and that, you know, it's great to build products for 20-something people with disposable income. Nothing against that, but there's a lot of other people to build great products for and a lot of other markets that I think have yet to be cracked.
That was Catherine Minshew, founder and CEO of The Muse. Every day, you and I interact with the world of tech.
Today, we're going to be showing our friends the basics of technology.
Eventually, seeing people using cellular phones may seem as commonplace as someone checking time on an electronic watch, figuring on an electronic calculator, or programming on an electronic computer.
This is Tech in Real Life.
Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. Hello, Ben.
Hi, Lizzie. You got an iPhone, right? You update yet?
Yeah, I have an iPhone and it is sitting right here.
Okay.
It wants me to update.
It always, isn't that funny how it always wants
it really
you to update?
Always wants me to update. But it also says this update cannot be installed because it requires at least 4.6 gigs of storage. I don't have that.
What do you got on there? What's on your phone?
I have a lot of videos of the dog, of the family dog running around.
Is it all backed up to your iCloud?
Maybe.
Then you could probably erase it. I don't know. It's a little scary. It's scary, right?
This is why I have you. You're my guide to tech in real life. I can come into your office and say, Ben, I did something terrible to my phone. Please fix it.
How old is your phone? Which version of the iPhone is that?
It's a 5.
Okay.
But I dropped it in some... It's not the happiest of phones.
You've taken a lot of video with this phone.
Well, you know, he's a really cute dog.
Yeah, it's understandable. So here's what I think is interesting about this. How do you feel about updating? Are you like a happy-go-lucky updater?
I am not. The last time I tried to update, it was a complete nightmare. And I have seen reports of people trying to update to iOS 8 or the new version of iOS 8. Everybody's
yes.
complaining. There are people taking screenshots where it just looks like a giant failure or even jokes of that where they're putting these little icons and it's just, you know, 12 icons of Bono's face. You know, all the things
right.
you
right.
didn't want.
That's
Bono,
right.
Bono, 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 more Bono. So convince me that there is ever a legit reason to do a system update on my phone, because right now I'm super skeptical.
So I want you to know that I'm with you. I also just fundamentally distrust the update. I think it's natural. because often what happens is we update software and then it doesn't work, or it doesn't work the same way as before, or we have trouble navigating, et cetera, et cetera. But there are several good reasons to update.
Lay them on me.
Okay. So a lot of developers, even though we might not believe this, a lot of developers are always working on the software within an operating system to make it better, to make things run more efficiently, to save your battery life, to help you do all sorts of things with your phone in a better way. Actually, security as well is something that they try and fix.
I don't want
updates.
People stealing those awesome videos of the dog.
I don't think you should. It also, admittedly, comes with new ways for a company to try and maybe sell you stuff or say to you, hey, you know, you really should update your hardware as well as your software since, you know, we really want you to update the software. So there is a sort of
So there's a dollar motive behind this.
Of course. Absolutely. I mean, why else would Apple release a new operating system once a year and a new phone once a year and have them happen at the same time, right? So there is that aspect of it. But the vast majority of changes in operating system updates, generally speaking, are truly focused on making your life easier. Now, one example, you may have heard about shell shock, this huge security flaw found in operating systems that people have been talking about this past week. Well, the way security flaws like shell shock and Heartbleed before it, if you remember that one,
yep,
often get the teeth taken out of them is through patches and updates. So updates can be a good thing.
So if you're a regular old person and you're trying to sort through all of this stuff and how it affects your life, what's the best rule of thumb? How do you operate? No pun intended.
Well, it was a good pun. I think the best way to operate is to use a certain amount of caution. Now, as you were mentioning, the iOS 8 update was buggy. Then Apple released a new iOS 8.0.1 update that was also buggy. And then the company pulled that update and then immediately started furiously working on the newest update. So this is something that you have to be careful of. You don't necessarily want to be the first kid in the update pool, right? Maybe wait a little while. A lot of experts say it's really important to wait a couple days, just see how the update goes, let the bugs get worked out. Something that's interesting about iOS 8 specifically is 33% of iPhone users updated immediately, like in the first several days that it was available. And that's because people want the new operating system that's fancy and new and cool, et cetera, et cetera. But it can be problematic. So it's good to wait. I would suggest maybe even just wait a week and see what gets updated, what gets fixed, see what the coverage is in the media about what needs to get fixed. And just, you know, take your time, check the pool out before you jump in.
Ben Johnson, host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Lizzie.
Get some of our tech in your life. Download the Marketplace app. You can get it on Google Play or in the iTunes Store. You're listening to Marketplace Weekend from APM. We've been talking tech, and just about every tech reporter in the world is writing about the new iPhone 6 and the iPhone 6 Plus. And Marketplace's digital producer, Ariana Tobin, noticed a little something about their stories. It had to do with pockets. They kept asking, are the phones too big? Are they too big for practical purposes in people's lives? Ariana, take it away.
And a lot of the men who were writing about this, and many tech reporters, tech reviewers are men, were saying, well, can it fit in my pocket?
Pocketability is another issue. At 71 millimeters thick, the iPhone 6 Plus is thin enough to fit into your pocket. Kind of.
And the more I read, can it fit in my pocket, my thought was, well, it has never been able to fit in my pocket. Like, I've never carried my phone in my pocket. That's crazy. For men, this is like the first time that that's ever really been a question and come up. So I wanted to go back and see where that had come from.
People who design pants don't like us.
And maybe they think we all have small hands, which I don't. No.
Because their hands are smaller than men's.
I borrowed my wife's pants because they're like those super stretchy pants that just so happen to fit me. But I realized when I was driving that all my stuff would always fall out of the pockets. And it never hit me until right now that there are just smaller pockets.
It's teased, though, when you see that little line that's supposed to be a pocket and you think you can dig into your pocket and you can't. Sucks.
I've got this big old hefty wallet, okay. Like my phone. I've got like all my money and all my change in there.
But like, are we talking about the really small pockets? Like the fake pockets? Maybe they just want to save fabric.
Like a lot of the people that we just heard from, I had theories too, and I wanted to know, is it because they wanted to save fabric? Is it because people just thought it was ugly? Was it anatomical reasons? Was there, you know, some kind of strange 18th century doctor who thought that it was unsanitary for women to have their hands too close to their bodies? And I think the answer is more straightforward than that. It is all of those forces kind of rolled up into one, creating the fashion that you see in a department store when you walk into a Macy's today. Lucy Lockett lost her pocket, and then when she found it, there wasn't a penny in it, but it had a ribbon around it. I think that's right? Lucy Lockett lost her pocket, Kitty Fisher found it. When I was little, I was always confused by how you could possibly lose a pocket. Like, what does that mean? And the answer is because in the 17th century and the 18th century, women wore these great big pockets, and everybody who wore any kind of clothing wore great big pockets. In the later 18th century, as the neoclassical style came into being, as the Greek goddesses were all the rage, women stopped wearing bigger pockets, like especially fashionable, upper-class, wealthy women stopped wearing great big pockets. Goddesses don't wear pockets. Greek goddesses don't wear pockets. Not in any text that these fashion designers of the late 18th century could find. Katharine Hepburn was interviewed by Barbara Walters, and she talks about what it was like for her to be wearing what was traditionally considered men's clothing for the first time.
I put on pants 50 years ago and declared a sort of middle road. And I ain't afraid of being alone.
Is that why also you wear pants?
No, I just wear pants because they're comfortable.
Do you ever wear a skirt, by the way?
I have one.
You have one?
Wear it to your funeral.
You'll wear it to my funeral.
Wearing pants that looked like men's pants, it was definitely a mark of something changing in the gender norms of the time. It wasn't until the 1970s that pants were really embraced in earnest. And that was a combination of you have the feminist movement on one hand being like women should be able to wear clothes that free them up to do the work that men can do. But it was also the fashion magazines had taken them up. Like all of a sudden this was fashionable, this was popular, this was something that they could sell as like a new way to be feminine. And over time, you still have those two forces at play. So you have women's pants that are made to look like women's pants, specifically with small pockets. You don't have the very masculine gesture of people sticking their hands in their pockets in fashion magazines, unless they want to make a point. And like, there's a very famous Katharine Hepburn picture of her standing against a wall with her hands in her pockets, smoking a cigar, making that point that she's doing something very masculine. And you still hear that sometimes today, like, and you know, that Alanis Morissette song, I'm probably reading too much into it, but she has one hand in her pocket and the other one making a peace sign or smoking a cigarette. She's alluding to those earlier moments of women taking on masculine poses, wearing masculine clothing, saying, I don't care what it is that you expect of me. Like, you know, I don't care what else is going on around me. I've got my hand in my pocket and all is fine. They said everything's gotta be quite hard. And one interesting thing that the fashion historian I spoke with mentioned was it's interesting because technology affects everything. Like the work that you do, it takes time sometimes. But this outcry over the iPhone, like you kind of have to wonder, like she was saying, well, will men start carrying backpacks? Like will men start carrying, is this the advent of the MRS? Like are we actually going to have a moment where pockets go out of style for men and they start carrying bags instead? I'm curious to see what happens, like what we're wearing in 15 to 20 years, what we're carrying on our wrists and hands and in our pants.
That was Marketplace's Ariana Tobin. Thanks to Deborah Brose, Wanda Lee, Balwaldo Fernandez, Andy Hingle, Liz Getz, and Ariel Verhez for weighing in on why women's pockets can be kind of useless. And the memory of the inimitable Katharine Hepburn for timeless inspiration. And that's it. That's Marketplace Weekend for this week. Our show is always a conversation, and not just on the weekend. Come talk to us anytime on MarketplaceWeekend.org or tweet us at MarketplaceWKND. Tell us what you think. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Jenny Amond, Raghu Manavalan, and John Sepulvedo. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer. Jeff Peters is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.